Thank you. Good morning, everybody. And thank you for coming to a talk that may not have anything to do with GRBs. Transparencies. It's the process of preparing them that I enjoy, so this will not be the only talk on transparencies because I'm talking again on Friday. When I made this, Ken and I were talking about me offering one talk, but now it's been split. So in general, what I'm talking about this week will be probing the nature of type 1 supernovae with spectroscopy. But as it turns out, for today, very brief introduction, and then we'll be concerned today with type 1A. Two main parts that I'd like to talk about. Arranging maximum light spectra, and we'll see what I mean by that in a couple of minutes. And a new subtype of type 1As. I think this is very interesting. A new subclass, we can say. SN2002 CX lights. And then on Friday we'll come to type 1B and type 1C, so I won't say any more about that right now. So the very brief introduction includes reminding those who don't look at spectra all that often about the spectral classification of supernovae. I've left type 2s off. Everybody knows that type 2 supernovae are those that have conspicuous or obvious hydrogen lines, Balmer lines. If you have to argue about it or wonder about whether they're present, then they're not type 2s. They're type 1s. We'll talk more about that on Friday quite a bit. But if they're obvious, they're type 2s, and that's not here. They're not here. So we're focusing today on the type 1As, and there's a normal one up there, 1994D, and the characteristic spectral features, the most characteristic spectral features, I put in red. This is the deep red silicon 2 line, and to the left of it is what I think I'll call this the main silicon 2 line, and this is the secondary silicon 2 line to the left. It's not labeled silicon 2, but it is thought to be silicon 2. And also characteristic of type 1As is this sulfur W kind of feature with two dips. Nobody has ever, as far as I know, suggested that the presence of sulfur 2 in any other type of supernova, only in type 1As. So it's not as deep as the silicon 2, so we refer to the silicon 2 as the characteristic feature, but the sulfur 2 is characteristic as well. Well, as long as we have these here, we'll do a little 1B and 1C just for contrast. Here's a normal 1B, and it does not have a deep, it doesn't have those features, but since it's a 1B, then by definition of 1B, it has strong, obvious features of neutral helium. Again, if one must argue about whether the helium is present or not, that doesn't make it a 1B. It's only if one looks and says, oh, yes, it's neutral helium. And then this feature in blue, I'll come back to on Friday.
David?
Yes?
Can I ask you?
Yes?
All type 1As have sulfur?
Yes. As far as
all
I know, all...
Bs?
Yes. Yes. All. Right. And thank you for reminding me this is supposed to be informal, I was told, so interruptions are welcome at any time. And we can stop and discuss things. Down here is a type 1C, spectroscopically normal one, 1994I, and it doesn't have the characteristic features of either of these, so by contrast it's a little bit bland, the spectrum of a type 1C, and I want to talk about that feature on Friday. And then down here is, you might call it a 1C peculiar, or you might call it a hypernova, 1998 BW. These are all spectrum near maximum. Yes, it says up there, near maximum. And by the way, when you see this word tilted or tilt on my transparencies, it just means that I've taken the freedom to tilt the spectrum up or down, blue or red. It's just so that I can present a better view of all the features across the optical spectrum. If the spectrum is hot, for example, and you plot F lambda, then the spectrum goes way up to the blue, and you can't see what's on the red edge. The features are compressed. So when I say tilted, I've just taken the the liberty to make them more or less flat across the optical. I find that that helps a lot in comparing features. Okay, so then I was mentioning 98BW. I will have only a little to say about these on Friday. Paolo Mazzoli has done a lot about the spectra of the hypernovae, and I'm sure you're going to hear from him, but not this week, is my understanding. Okay.
When you made these classifications, is it always you use the near maximum? Do the spectra change that much?
Well, actually, we'll see. We'll see how they change. But you don't need a spectrum near maximum to make a classification. But since most spectra tend, especially in the past, to have been obtained near maximum when the supernova is brightest, we usually look at the maximum spectra. But you can tell them apart at other epochs, except 1Bs and 1Cs tend to look very similar at late times. Can't tell which is which. Okay, so the problem with supernova spectroscopy, of course, is that the ejection velocity, characteristic ejection velocity, is 10,000 kilometers per second. That's 3% of C. And so we have Doppler broadening, and we have blending. And so when you look at the entire optical spectrum, you see you get an order of 10 features to work with, and you have to worry about whether any one of them is an unblended feature. In general, it's not. So that means that the amount of analysis that you can do by slapping a ruler on spectra, the way one might do with a stellar spectrum, is limited because of the blending. And so those of us who try to, those of us like, let's see, in this room, it's Paolo and Daniel and me, and as far as I know, we're the only three who really care about every single wiggle in the spectrum. But those of us who are fascinated by that, we approach the problem usually with synthetic spectra, because then you can calculate blends and compare to the observed spectra. So I thought I would, it's partly for my benefit, just summarize the synthetic spectrum codes that are in so far used a lot, and say a little bit about the difference. So the code that I use and have been using for some time is called SINO. It stands for Synthetic Spectrum Now, because it's very simple and very fast. So it's a highly parameterized code that assumes that lines form by resonance scattering. And there's much more detail I could talk about, but I won't. But I want to point out that with the SINO code, we input the line optical depth, for any line we're interested in, as a function of the radial coordinate, which is velocity. Because for a supernova, the explosion velocity law is V proportional to R. Very important that we know that. It's a good approximation ordinarily. So we actually have control of optical depth of a line as a function of velocity. And we use this code in a really empirical spirit. It's not a sophisticated radio transfer code by any means, but we use it to work interactively fitting spectra and trying to reach conclusions about which lines are present, which velocity range, in which velocity range are they present, things like that. I think of it as almost an experimental tool. And then in increasing complexity, perhaps, there's the code that I call Mazzoli-Lucy that Paolo uses a lot. It's a Monte Carlo code. And it does various things that SINO does not do, including calculating ionization structure, which we don't attempt to do. But it doesn't input tau V. It inputs a density structure and a composition, and then the spectrum comes out as it comes out. I wanted to mention this because you're going to be hearing much, I think, in the future about Dan Kaysen and his Monte Carlo code. Now, Dan's a postdoc. He hasn't been at this game very long. He's at Johns Hopkins right now. But his is a 3D Monte Carlo code, and he also calculates spectral polarization. And he has some very nice new results on type 1As, but his code will apply to any supernova. And since he has a long future ahead of him, I think he'll do a great deal to advance supernova spectroscopy. And then the full non-LTE codes, the biggest codes, where they try to put in all relevant physics, everything they can. Relativity, non-LTE, so solving rate equations, which is not done in any of the above codes. So there, that's my colleague at Oklahoma, Eddie Barron, and his collaborators uses the Monster Phoenix code. It has 1,000 times more lines of code than CINAHL, and it takes 1,000 times longer to run, too. And then Peter Huthwick, I don't know if he named his code, but of course he's a group unto himself. He has a non-LTE code. And then there's a new emergent group. Luke, I met this guy, Luke Gassard, he's a postdoc also, and John Hillier at Pitt. They've developed a non-LTE code at the same kind of level as these other codes. And so far they've only applied it to, they're just getting started, they've applied it to type 2. I think their intention, my understanding is their intention is to get to all types eventually, but 2 might be the place to start. So what I'm going to say today is just about, I'm using the CINAHL code, the simplest one. And here's a cartoon that is student made recently, left off one very important part, so I scrawled it on there. The CINAHL code, I told you it was a resonant scattering code, line forms by resonant scattering. It makes some sweeping assumptions. I regard CINAHL as the most simple, useful code. Anything more simple than CINAHL wouldn't really be very useful. So the idea is it assumes a sharp photosphere that emits a continuum, and we just send off a black body continuum off the photosphere because we're not doing continuum radiative transport. And then if the observer is to the left, there's a region from which the observer can receive scattered photons and they will make an emission part of a line profile. And there's a region here where some of the photons from the photosphere in the direction of the observer will get scattered out of the line of sight, and so you get a blue shifted absorption part of the profile, and then O is for occultation back here because nothing can get to the observer. Even if it's scattered in the observer's direction back there, it can't get there. So you end up with what's called a P-Cygni profile, as you probably know, unshifted emission peak and a blue shifted absorption. And the thing I wanted to stress is that for most moving atmospheres, stellar winds, novae, whatever, a big uncertainty is what is the velocity law? What is V as a function of the radial coordinate? Even thinking 1D, never mind 3D. But for supernovae, because the explosion happens promptly and then soon the material goes and starts coasting, then by the time we see the supernova, in ordinary circumstances, barring circumstellar interaction or something like that, V equals R over T, simply from coasting. So at a given time, velocity is proportional to radius. So we can use, I always think of velocity as the radial coordinate, not R. And that is a very powerful thing to know. So for supernova spectroscopy, the bad thing is the blending, because there are high velocities involved. But the very good thing is we know the velocity law.
What's your continuum towards
I don't, it's not specified in CINAHL. We just say there's a sharp photosphere and it radiates a black body continuum. And as you'll see, the black body continuum doesn't always fit the underlying continuum.
In
reality, yes, I think of the bottom of the line formation layer is where tau, yes, the electron scattering optical depth reaches unity. That's not true absorption, of course, but once you get down below that, you won't really see much line formation because the lines, any line formation below electron scattering optical depth unity, you're going to get washed out. So yes, it's all electron scattering at maximum light, at least. Now there's a quasi continuum of lines too.
So it's really a modified black body.
If you actually wanted to do a continuum calculation, yes, it would not end up coming out as a black body. Yes, right. And people do that, but in CINAHL we just don't do that. Just assume the photosphere is radiating like a black body. Okay, so that was the brief introduction, and then I have two parts to talk about. The first part, let's see, I'll introduce it this way. I called it some recent CINAHL work on type 1A as well. I put this up here simply so that you see what 1 and 2 means. We're doing, with lots of help, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 undergraduate students, a graduate student, a very senior postdoc, and my colleague Eddie Barron at Oklahoma. But if I'm mainly responsible for this work. What we're doing is a comparative direct analysis, direct meaning in the empirical spirit with CINAHL, as opposed to using models. We're trying to look at all of, we are looking at all of the good type 1A spectra that we can get our hands on. And we're interested in understanding every unit of the spectrum, identifying the lines as best we can, talking about velocity intervals, that sort of thing. Now, I'm going to de-emphasize that this morning. I'm going to show some of it, but I don't want to end up talking just to Paulo and Daniel. So I'll de-emphasize that part and put a little more emphasis on a different part. And the different part, well, a related part, is we're interested in trying to understand the spectroscopic diversity of type 1As. And in particular, I'd like to know whether type 1As, when you examine them closely, do they break up into discrete subgroups? Or are they, from the spectroscopic point of view at least, are they basically a continuous distribution? So that we would have, in the latter case, differences of degree rather than differences of kind if they break up into discrete subgroups. So I'll put a little more emphasis on that. Okay, so paper one, we took 26 spectra of the normal 1994D, a very well-observed one, and we just did our best analysis we could from 12 days before maximum light to 115 days after, and all a lot of stuff about line identifications and so forth, and that's published, so I won't say anything about that. That was published early 2005. But then paper two, is what I'm going to talk about now. That this is about to be accepted, I'm pretty sure. And it deals only with maximum light spectra. Then we'll go on to paper three, which started, that'll be pre-maximum. We'll work our way backwards in time, and then paper four will be post-maximum. But I won't be talking about those today either. So what we have today, this is on AstroPH. I just put it on last week so that if anybody wants to know details, I can say, hey, it's on AstroPH. We have spectra of 24 type 1A supernovae within 3 days of maximum, so we call them maximum light, and that's what we'll be looking at now. First of all, something from a paper back in 1995 by Nugent et al. This was actually, he was a grad student at Oklahoma when he did this. I just wanted to explain something. Nugent looked at the main silicon line and the secondary silicon line to the left, and he just defined a parameter called R of SI2 that many people have heard of, but probably not everybody. R stands for a ratio, because he just takes the ratio of this line depth to that line depth, and that is R of SI2. And it turns out that it correlates very nicely with, here it's shown correlating with absolute magnitude of type 1As. It also correlates with the decline rate parameter delta M15 of Phillips. And there's more data now to show that the correlation is actually quite nice. So it's a spectroscopic observable that varies from type 1A to type 1A. Well, what we're doing here is, on the next transparency, you're going to see the equivalent width of these two lines, each plotted separately. We're going to plot one against the other. We're not taking the ratio here. So that's what you see there. And this will take just a little bit of explaining. Okay, so what we've plotted on the x-axis is the equivalent width of the 6100 is the angstroms, is the main silicon 2 line. So from left to right, these are things that have weak silicon 2 lines by type 1A standards, and over there they're very strong. Big equivalent widths. These are pseudo-equivalent widths since we don't really know where the continuum is. They're equivalent width-like quantities. And then this is 5750. That's near the wavelength of the other silicon 2 line. And so that goes from weak or even unmeasurable down here at zero up to much stronger in certain types. So that's what's plotted. Now the arrows are something else. Because when we plot one thing against another, we're just looking at two features of the spectrum, of course. But then the arrows refer to looking at the whole optical spectrum and looking at the logarithmic flux differences across the spectrum and looking for each supernova, you look for its nearest neighbor. Which other supernova has the minimum logarithmic flux differences? Then summed all across the spectrum. So it's just a way of quantifying the nearest neighbor. So when you see a double-headed arrow, that means here's one whose name is not on. It's 97 cm. Have to fix that. I think it's right in the submitted version. Anyway, double-headed arrow means they're mutual nearest neighbors. And a single-headed arrow, such as this one, means, okay, the nearest neighbor of 84A is this one, but the nearest neighbor of this one is not 84A, it's this one. So the arrows are a different way of connecting these. This is what I meant by arranging the spectrum. So we're actually doing it in two ways. Now you see different symbols and colors. That's because we're breaking them on names. We're breaking these supernovae up into four groups. And I'm going to show you what their spectra look like, of course.
Sorry,
yes?
Can I ask what the typical errors are?
Yes, we do say in the paper, since we didn't want to clutter this, that for our purpose of arranging it, the errors are not important, but they're not negligible. You can define, as long as you accept equivalent width, the light quantity, you just lay a line across the silicon line. The main one, the errors really are small, unless the line gets very weak. And for this one, the errors are not negligible, but for just as opposed to trying to get reproducible results. Just for doing this, it's not important. Except that when it gets very weak down here, you see we plotted these at zero because we can't tell. The fractional error then is quite significant, but it's not important for what I'm doing today. It's fine.
How much is the space dimension of this metric or whatever? How many parameters do you use to calculate the distance between the supernovae?
I'm not sure what you're asking about. Each one of these, each symbol is simply plotting the equivalent width against another equivalent width, right? We just measure two equivalent widths in the spectrum. But if you're asking about the arrows, they're the nearest neighbor. It's across the entire optical spectrum. What we do is we put them on a 2-angstrom grid. So we have a flux point every 2 angstroms for every supernova. And then we use the maximum wavelength range available to us in the optical spectrum. And then we look for the minimum of the logarithmic flux differences.
So roughly how many parameters have you used?
Oh, well, there's no parameter. It's just arithmetic. But it's at many wavelength points. If we have, say, 4,000 angstroms and every 2 angstroms, we have 8,000 points. But it's not a fitting procedure of any kind. It's just a calculation. It's a chi-squared-like figure of merit that we really use, yes. Okay, right. So, I was about to say we divide these into four groups and we give them names. But now, before you start worrying about, well, how does he know to make these guys, well, I'm now calling these core normal, and we'll see why, because the normal and the normal are very similar to each other, and they're the black circles. Well, how does he know that 92A goes that way, and that 99E goes that way? The referee is worried about this too. The point is, I'm going to conclude in the end that it doesn't really matter, because I'm going to conclude that rather than being discrete subgroups, it's more of a continuous. We have a very strong impression of a continuous distribution. And if that's true, then it doesn't really matter where we draw the boundaries of the core. This is for purposes of presentation. Okay?
How does this transform
your
delusion plot?
The Nugent plot is the ratio of two depths of these two. Now, these are equivalent widths, but a line of constant R of SI2 is a straight line starting from the origin, which is here. So a line of constant R of SI2 goes like that, right? Another one goes like that. So now we're looking at two parameters rather than collapsing it into one. We just have more data, and we're trying to take a closer look. So we can imagine. But everything, draw a line like this, they all have the same R of SI2. Yeah, but they don't have the same line strength, so we see more information here.
So the data for this coordinate is of the expansion velocity and...
No, it's simply the equivalent width, nothing to do with the velocity. Just the equivalent width of the deep silicon 2 line and the secondary.
Well, velocity information because the width is the width of the depth.
So sure.
The velocity is partially in there, but it's not the whole stuff.
Yes, the velocity, the optical depth is a function of velocity, affects what the equivalent width will be. But for the purpose of, as an observable, you just measure the equivalent width. You just lift straight line across the top of the spectrum.
So even the core and the core normal, there's a continuum? I mean,
well, that's a good question, and the referee wants us to take this out of this, and I don't want to. I'm going to show you why, but I'm not going to belabor, that point since it's details of spectroscopy. The biggest, since we'll get ahead of it now. Yeah, I'll get ahead of myself, thanks to you. whether these are a discrete group. Now, they look very different on here, but this is a particular parameterization. My opinion is that it's not at all clear that these are a discrete group, and if I had to bet, I would say that there is a continuum from the core even up to these, and the reason is, to get ahead of myself some more, as you go to a supernova that make less nickel, like 91BG, you know it's dim, it doesn't make much nickel, the supernova gets cooler. And as you go cooler, you can expect a threshold below which the spectral features change a lot. You go from certain ions being dominant to others. In particular, Ti2 comes up when the supernova gets cool. So I think there may be a narrow temperature range between here and here and here. I also may be wrong, so that's debatable. There's plenty of room for difference of opinion on that. This other stuff, I have strong impression of continuity until we get to O2CX, and I better skip some things so that, because I do want to show you the O2CX, because I know you haven't seen that. It's not published.
So what is the K time as a metric for delta M15, with arrows being pretty much the same?
This is simply based on maximum light spectra, no photometric quantities whatsoever. So you're asking, what if we...
But you know the ratio,
because
yeah.
I see, you know, it's like very far away.
Yes. We might want to talk about that later, since otherwise I'm going to go off on a tangent. Not really prepared to answer that, although we have looked at the delta M15s of all these, but as Paolo just said, we know that the ratio, which is a line like that, this has a high R of SI2, these have low, correlates with delta M15 rather well. So the high delta M15s are up here. The low delta M15s, the slow decliners, are down in this corner, and so forth. Okay. But for this one, we've kept it purely spectroscopic, so I don't have the answer.
So tip of my tongue. I asked the dimension of this problem because we did in many papers. Firstly, you just use the principal component analysis to find how many principal component or real dimension you have. And later, there are many standard statistical procedures to get how many groups or whatever.
Yes, right. We have plans. Students will develop those things. But here, we're just looking. Okay. Now, that is the main figure of this paper that has many figures, so now I'm just going to show you rather quickly what these different groups look like. So these are the core normals. It's just a new term that means more normal than normal. You know, in the traditional classification, we have spectroscopically normal type 1As, and then we have peculiarly 91BG likes.
Aren't these the branch normal?
I'm not allowed to use that term. Then they say branch peculiar. And Vandenberg said branch Davidians in public. No, we have spectroscopically normal in the broad sense. But you look at it, that's a normal type 1A. I still use the term that way. And then we have the 91BGs are very peculiar in one respect, and the 91Ts are very peculiar in a different respect. But here we're trying to slice it finer. So this is not just spectroscopically normal, these are core normal. There's the thing. There's 7 or 8 of them on here. This is the equivalent width of the main silicon line running down here. And they are, I'll never get over this homogeneity, the spectroscopic homogeneity. They are awfully similar. And then, of course, if you look at the arrows, you'll see that O1EL is a special case. I have an arrow here and 3 arrows there. And that has to do with line formation at high velocity, as these two guys know. But we include O1EL in the high velocity, meaning highly detached from the photosphere. But we include O1EL here because apart from the features that are forming at high velocity, its photospheric spectrum just fits in very nicely with the others. So this to me is the core. And what it means is that we have, even if we don't talk about line identifications, it means that you have a repeatable explosion mechanism for type 1As, a standard repeatable explosion mechanism, and it can't be too chaotic in any respect, at least any respect above 12,000 kilometers per second where the lines are forming. You can't have like too many big lumps of things up there, because then what you see would depend on aspect. It would depend on your orientation as the observer. So this means there is a core explosion mechanism. I've always thought that, but this is, again, zeroing in on things that are really repeatable. Now, just and said I'm not going to show you a whole lot of synthetic spectra. If I do, I'll flash them at you, at least from this part of the talk. But here's 94D just to show what a fit looks like. One of the core normals. And again, it's tilted so that we can see both ends of the spectrum. And the black on all these this kind of plots, the black is the observed. And the red is a synosynthetic spectrum, and I've written the velocity at the photosphere. It's just a fitting parameter, 12,000 kilometers per second, of course, in this case. This, for people who aren't used to the spectroscopy, this deep thing and that deep thing, that's telluric. That's the Earth's atmosphere, so we're not trying to fit those. We are trying to fit this, however, and you see that this is what the black body assumption does. The black body continuum, it clearly goes too high over here, and so our oxygen feature, synthetic, it's up here instead of down there. So we don't make too much of that. So by our standards, that's a pretty good fit. One more thing I should say, in case you're curious, there's two synthetic spectra on here. The dashed ones do not have high velocity detached FE2 lines forming at around 20,000 kilometers per second, and the solid curves do. So it's to show the difference. And that's, again, that's a spectroscopic detail that you don't want to hear too much about, perhaps. But it just shows what happens if we don't include high velocity iron 2. So I think it's ubiquitous in supernovae, the high velocity iron 2. I think Paolo agrees. Okay. Broad line. So what's the difference with them? When you actually look at the whole spectrum. The most famous, okay, at the top we start with a core normal, so 94D again, just for comparison. And then at the bottom we have the most famous broad line supernova, type 1A, 1984A. And at a glance, you can these are logarithmic, so the vertical shift is arbitrary, and so you really can compare the equivalent width with your eye, or the depth, or the width, whatever you want, of 84A's silicon line and 94D, and you see this one is much bigger. And here is, in a nutshell, an impression of continuity. Here's the equivalent widths of the lines, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger until they get to the champion. And I don't see, you know, where to draw a cut. I see continuity. So if we want to fit the most extreme, of course we fit them all, because we're trying to have what we call an internally consistent quantification of the spectra of type 1A, so we publish all our fitting parameters. But here is the most extreme case, the 84A. And the point is that although it's different from the core normals, it's no more mysterious from the point of view of fitting it spectroscopically than the core normals. It's exactly the same ions as we use in the core normals. It's even got the same velocity at the photosphere in this fit. It's just that the difference is the optical depth gradient is more shallow in these guys. Now, whether that's because burning extended to higher velocities, or whether it's just that the density is higher at higher velocities, we can't answer that question here, or at least it would be very difficult to try. I don't think it would be a rewarding exercise. But they just have a shallower optical depth gradient for whatever reason. But otherwise, they're not much more mysterious. We use exponential optical depth, and for the core normals, we're using the E-folding velocity is 1,000 kilometers per second. So the optical depth goes down by E every 1,000. And for these, we're using, for the extreme case, we're using maybe 4,000 kilometers per second. And the intermediates, we used 2,000, 3,000. So we didn't change V-fold. We thought we would, but we ended up just changing the optical depth gradient. Okay, let's go to the cools. The ones that include, now again, as usual, I take a core normal at the top, and I just take the one that looks most like the next one. And so that's a core normal, 90N. And then there's 89B, the one where we wondered, well, should it be in the core or not? And it's arguable. And I think I won't go into why I like it on this plot unless you ask. And then we get down here. Did somebody ask? Okay. please let me keep going so I can show you O2CX, and then we'll come back to anything you want. Down here is 91 BG, which is the most famous of these guys, the subluminous, peculiar, spectroscopically peculiar, photometrically peculiar. You heard of it, I'm sure. Okay, so here, again, skipping over the 89B issue, 86G is on its way down there. Nobody would deny that. See, what happens down here, we usually refer to this thing, which breaks out in the cools and is not in the core normals, as the blue TI2 trough. But I put it in quotes because now that we try to really fit the spectrum, we realize, yeah, TI2 and other ions whose lines tend to come in at low temperature but are not important in normals. Now, 86G already, you see, is developing the TI2 trough, and then 99BY has it. 97CM, the one whose name didn't appear before, they're down here. So, the question of continuity came up before, and it's arguable, it's debatable, whether there's continuity or whether we should just separate these out and say 89B goes elsewhere. I'd be happy to discuss that with people, but I don't think everybody wants to hear the details of that.
There was no continuity.
No continuity. After...
Now
you require me to say something. All right. You mentioned 2 hours yesterday. Okay. All right. Why are we doing this? Well, for one thing, the spectrum... these guys have VFOC that is lower. In our fitting parameter, it comes out lower. Not a lot lower, it's 11,000 kilometers per second. The normals have 12 or 13. 89B, we fit it with 11,000 kilometers per second, like these. And that is because the features, if you look closely, they're more resolved in this guy. Now, 91 is the most close I can get to this one, so it looks pretty darn similar. But that is one of the reasons why we take 89B and put it here. Another reason is that if you remember these equivalent widths of the core normals, none of them approached 124, so this guy has a stronger line. And in fact, the nearest neighbor of one of these is the other. So this silicon line is just like this silicon line. So that's some of our reasons for doing that. Remember, what I said before is the boundaries of the core don't really matter, but whether there's continuity or whether the 91BG lights are special, well, that does matter, whether they're differences of kind. So just fitting a 91BG spectrum, we had a lot of fun with this because it gets complicated when you get to a cooler supernova because more ions break out, ions that you don't worry about in the normals. And so, okay, we floated 11,000. Here's the Sinnoh failure again, the continuum. And then other than that, we can fit it fairly well. But over in here, we brought in ions TI2, scandium-2, calcium-1. The ones I can swear to are TI2. I'm sure that's correct. But scandium-2, chromium-2, calcium-1, I cannot swear. It's just that it's the way we can fit them. Somebody asked, I think it was Philip, does you always see sulfur 2? And it crossed my mind there's a slight caveat here. When you go to the cools, scandium 2 has lines in the same neighborhood, and they do show up in type 2s, for sure. So it could be that we're looking at scandium 2 and not sulfur 2, but I think...
There's
the velocity at the photosphere. That's a fitting parameter. And then for every ion, we simply have a parameter to scale up its strength. We can make it stronger or weaker. We're not using even the Saha equation to calculate how strong it is. We're just asking, is it present by scaling it up? Then the other lines of that ion, we just use Boltzmann excitation at some excitation temperature, some standard nominal value. So I could count up the parameters for you, but it's easier to just admit we have lots. We're just trying to fit the spectrum.
Do those change a lot? Is it roughly the same parameters for all of them?
Yes, for the core normals, because they're so homogeneous, the differences between the parameters are hardly trustworthy. But when you go to extreme cases like 91BG, well, then you have very different parameters. Some of the parameters are very different. We have this one other group. We've looked at three groups, so here's the fourth one. Shallow silicon is what I'm calling it. Again, the closest core normal up here, and then we go to 99 EE, and you may have wondered, well, should that be in the core? I don't want to argue about it, but I will say that its silicon 2 line, for one thing, is different. The equivalent width is similar, but it's broader and shallower than those in the core. It looks different to me. And besides, it looks like continuity coming down this way, where this thing is getting weaker and weaker. And then there's a bit of a jump till you get to 91T, which is famously peculiar for having a weak silicon 2 line. It's broad, but it's shallow. And then finally down here, 91T's nearest neighbor in this sample of two dozen is O2CX. And you see, this says Fe3. When you get to 91T, now you've got to a supernova that made lots of nickel, and so there's lots of heating. You see a hot spectrum. You don't see Ti2 anymore, but what becomes significant now, conspicuous now, is Fe3 as the most conspicuous features, these two features, whereas they're not prominent up here. O2CX likewise has the Fe3 features, and therefore it's down here. But I'm going to argue later, that it appears to be really different. I don't want to include it in the continuity claim. Okay, we can fit the shallows about as well as we fit the others. I think I'll skip that. Something of interest to me that I will skip also. I want to come to the conclusion, some of the conclusions of this. Again, more is on AstroPH as of last week. So let's wrap this up, at least for now, then we can come back to it if you want. I think I may as well just read it to you. So our impression is that maximum light spectra suggest continuity rather than discrete subgroups, differences of degree rather than differences of kind. And part of our reason for thinking that way is that temperature thresholds, as I mentioned briefly before, above and below which, if you're above, Fe3 will break out. And if you're below it, some threshold, Ti2 and its neighbors, its cousins, will break out. So they should be expected. So there may be just temperature thresholds where when you cross them, the spectrum changes a lot and you think you're looking at a whole different beast, but you're not really. If so, then, if so meaning continuity, then exactly how the boundaries of the core are drawn is unimportant, and it's really just a matter of presentation. And that's what I'm going to try to convince the referee. Down here, interesting recent work. Is Evan here? Yes, Evan's here. Right. There's recent evidence that looks pretty good to me. You haven't changed your mind? Type 1As appear to come... Type 1As appear to come from young, very young, for Type 1As, about 10 to 8 years, something like that. Maybe the youngest thing that you could expect could make a white dwarf. 10 to 8 years and old populations, old meaning 3 gigayears with some distribution about it, in roughly equal numbers. And there's two papers actually by the Minucci et al. Group, and then there's Evan and Wildsten. But our sample, now admittedly it's a sample of 24, and we're just looking at maximum light here. So we may learn something later when we go premax. Our sample does not obviously or manifestly split in half. I don't see how to split it in half. I keep saying continuity to you. So I was wondering, well, how do we reconcile these two things? And this is what I've got to offer. There may well be two binary star evolution paths to type 1As. Now I'm looking at Philip. One that requires short time and one that requires long time, just depending on what you have to do to get there, to the Chandra mass. But they could still produce similar outcomes. In other words, a carbon-oxygen white dwarf accreting and reaching the Chandra mass, so that they would not be distinguishable, at least not easily, in this way.
But wouldn't it make a lot more sense to continue this property of the projector system as well, since the outcome is continuous?
Say it again?
Why have two different channels that lead to something that spreads over a continuum?
Well,
continuum distribution.
Well, because the empirical evidence, assuming the empirical evidence is correct, mm-hmm. is that we really have two different groups. They're coming from two different age groups. Yeah. You looked at these papers? Okay, I'll get you two arguing.
I looked at the other one. I looked at the Manucci paper. I think it's based on really, really thin ground.
Okay. come, you should come. For those who don't know, Evan is Scarpieco. Okay.
It's pretty hard to imagine. So, what it's based on?
It's not the first suggestion that there's two paths to type 1As.
What's the main difference?
No, they're just counting rates, 1As in galaxies, different types of different colors. What you find is that the 1A rate in very young galaxies is kind of proportional to the quark collapse rate. Whereas if you go to, say, ellipticals, where you don't see any quark collapse, very few, then you still see a significant 1A contribution. So that's why you need two pieces.
Well, why does that mean that you need two pieces? If you have one distribution that goes all the way from zero to whatever, why wouldn't you get the same?
Well, the rates will come out wrong. The rate. You can't have a... Usually people fit the rate with a single decay. They say, okay, well, there's some time scale, like the delay time, and we're going to fix it.
How do you fit the delay? What functional form do you use?
Well, people have tried to use exponential decay or Gaussian and that sort of thing, and that doesn't fit this data.
But that doesn't make any sense, because no theoretical model predicts an exponential.
I think it's very hard to fit with a single time scale. Unless you take a very complicated functional form.
I want to.
This is not about rates, right? This is about the years.
I agree.
Yes.
I agree.
Yes.
We were always talking.
What's the difference about the appearance?
Okay, so our paper was only about rates.
Okay, so
there's nothing about appearance. So that's what I want to clear.
They could be reconciled. Assuming that that is right, what Evan is saying, then I would suggest the answer is okay. It produces two different roots. It's not new to suggest there's two different routes to type 1As. You have papers saying that main sequence. But there's papers that say there are two.
There's right? Different ways of getting them. I'm slightly skeptical of some of the analysis of Mnuchin. Again, I haven't seen yours, so I should discuss that. Because I don't think the analysis is correct.
Okay. Enrico may have wanted to comment. He knows about rates.
I agree that my point of view is that it's impossible from the current rate to divide two groups. But it is true that what you see is that there is evidence that some events are coming very quickly, mm-hmm. in a short time,
yeah.
and there is a long tail of events coming after a long time. But saying that there are distinct, I don't think there are data showing that. That's my
All right.
opinion. We'll discuss it.
I mean, I would agree with that because we have done also very detailed analysis. Right.
Okay, so then I would say that if you have roughly half of them in the prompt supernovae, and then even if it's not distinct, you have a long tail, I still ask myself the question, how do I divide these? I would still come to the same conclusion.
But you don't need to divide them because then it's just a continuum.
Well, yes. Okay. That's good. Yes, I'm arguing continuity, am I not? All right.
Except that the 91 VTs seem to be different.
I don't think so. In some respects, yes. They're just a little cooler.
This analysis was time evolution was involved.
I'm sorry.
There was time evolution involved in this analysis.
In our analysis?
Yeah.
All I've talked about today is maximum light spectra, so they're all essentially right at maximum light. And we'll be looking at the time evolution in next papers. Okay, so at least I have stimulated some discussion here. Some things for you guys to talk about later. Now, this you've seen before, but now we go to the O2CX for whatever time I have remaining. We saw this before, but now, before I underline 91T as sort of the bottom of this group, but now let's focus on O2CX. The observational paper was by Li et al. It's Weidong Li, Alex Filipenko's group, 2003. They published some spectra. I'm going to show them to you. And here again, I've marked the FE3 lines. And they were very brave. They didn't identify silicon 2 or sulfur 2 in the spectrum. They just identified FE3, and they said, oh, well, by connection with 91T, it must be a type 1A. Even though 91T is overluminous, it's a slow-declining supernova, overluminous, powerful type 1A, and this is quite subluminous. Almost like, it's like 91 BGs. And nevertheless, they said, they had a long discussion in the paper, but they said, it's a type 1A. And they were right. Then I published a paper on O2C X-ray, fit them with Cino, and this is both good and bad or sad. The velocity at the photosphere is only 7,000 kilometers per second. That's another difference between this guy and any other type 1A I had ever seen. When they published their observational paper, they said this is the most peculiar type 1A. We'll come back to that. But yes, I can fit the, if I fit the FE3 lines, then with the help of Cino, I begin to see, okay, there is a silicon line in there, and I think there's even sulfur, even if it doesn't fit very well. And then there's a lot of stuff that I haven't been able to identify yet, which really surprised me, because what Cino's good for is identifying features. Now there's calcium over here. So I certainly agreed with them that we have to include it in the type 1As. We can't sweep it aside. And then, now a little, some stuff that will come quickly. That was maximum light spectrum, right? So now, there's a supernova up there. It's about 2 months after maximum brightness now, called O5HK, and the observers are really hot after, many of the observers at least, really hot after this one, because they've realized it's like O2CX. Photometrically, Ray Don Lee has sent me the photometry. He calls it a carbon copy of O2CX. It's subluminous, and it has the same light curve. And they've sent me one spectrum so far. It's a very nice Keck spectrum, and that's the one in red. Now, on this one, they're both observed spectra. It's not Cino. The black is O2CX again, and the red is O5HK, a new name to get used to. And I've done, the vertical shift is arbitrary, of course, but I've done no horizontal shifting. And so you can see that O5HK is quite similar. It doesn't show the narrow line structure as much as O2CX, but its features, in general, are quite similar. So this is work in progress. I'm helping them, I'm providing Cino fits, but the paper will be by Chernock et al., a grad student. I believe he's still a grad student. One of Filipenko's at Berkeley. So, since O2CX had been unique, the observers are really trying to follow O5HK. And, of course, what I try to do is see if I can fit the spectrum. And if I just allow myself uncontroversial ions, I just put in the lines of 7 ions, I can get that much of a fit, which by my standards is fine as far as it goes. You're getting used to now seeing this failure over here, I hope. I don't have to comment on that anymore. It's fine as far as it goes, but it's incomplete. But those are ions that I think no one would argue, no spectroscopist would argue with me about. But if I allow myself to bring in other ions just to try to get a better fit, and I go to 12 ions, that is adding 5 more, then I get a fit that even in the UV, where it's usually problematic to fit that, by my standards, that's pretty good. So I think we're understanding pretty well which lines are present in the spectrum. Of course, I want to see more spectra at earlier times and later times. Now, let's work away from maximum light. That was a maximum light, so we've got two that are the same, roughly. They're obviously related. Now we've got later times. Well, this was published because this is my plot, but it's just a plot of the spectra that Li et al. Published of O2CX. This is the one we've been looking at, maximum light, but then plus 12, plus 25, plus 56. What this shows is the spectrum evolves. There was a question about spectral evolution. Well, there's a lot of spectral evolution here. Here I've not tilted them. It's just F sub mu, so you can see that the underlying shape has also changed, as well as the spectral features. And then in the paper that was published, I'll get to unpublished stuff shortly, paper that was published, I fit these later time spectra and was interested in the velocity at the photosphere in particular, what it was doing. So at plus 12 days up at the top, now we have a Cino fit in red, and again it's okay. Sure, it has its failures, but basically it's okay. And these are all permitted lines of familiar ions. But VFOAT is 7,000 kilometers per second. If we go to 25 days after maximum, It's a severe quality fit. I'm saying not bad. That jumps out at me. I don't like that. Don't like that, but most of the features are accounted for in a sensible way, I think. And so it's still all permitted lines, 25 days after maximum, and VFOAT has fallen to 5,000 kilometers per second, just lower than I'm used to with Type 1As. But if we go to 56 days, actually the 56-day spectrum, the observers in their paper, they said it had gone nebular, and they identified all the lines in a completely different way. They didn't do a calculation, they just labeled the lines as forbidden lines, because when Type 1As get old, their spectra become dominated by forbidden emission lines rather than permitted. But it's not that. It didn't go nebular. It's permitted lines forming the spectrum, but VFOAT is now down to 2,000 kilometers per second. In other words, these permitted lines are forming all the way down to 2,000 kilometers per second.
Even at maximum light, it was going slow.
Slow compared to others. And it's always slow compared to others, yes. But it gets worse. Yeah, because then we're there now. Because, This is what I wouldn't tell you yesterday. All right, this is another work in progress in collaboration with Filipenko's group. So the paper is, there's a draft, but it hasn't been submitted. They're hoping to submit it before January ends. So this would be Sarab Jha et al. He's a postdoc with Filipenko. And I'll put it up a little higher, because now it gets pretty strange. This is a normal. This is a core normal up here at 52 days after maximum. That's what the spectrum looks like. And this is O2CX at 56 days after maximum. That's the last one we looked at. It's the same one. I just showed you a fit. Well, how are they different? Well, they're different mainly in that the features are narrower, because VFOAT is lower in this guy than in this guy. So for one thing, as I could say later, O2CX is going to teach us something about line identifications, because when the lines are more nicely resolved, you can do a better job of resolving aliases. Okay, so that's not so strange. We thought it was really strange, actually, but compared to what happens later, it's not so strange. Here's again another core normal at 236 days after maximum. That's what the spectrum looks like. It's forbidden lines of FE2, FE3, so forth. But here's O2CX at 227 days. This is unpublished. It's from the Filipenko group. Now, at first glance, that looks like it needs to be smoothed. There's a lot of noise there. However, they have a spectrum at 277 days, too. And if you look closely, you find that the line, it's not noise. Some of it must be noise, but the lines are basically real. But they're very narrow. I've never seen a Type 1A look like that before. And just for comparison, here's another core normal down here. This is what a Type 1A is supposed to look like.
91 BG?
91 BG? No, it doesn't look like 91 BG.
It's not absorption.
No,
doesn't look much.
Another object with narrow lines and nebulous.
Yeah, but not this now. Let me show you how now. Plus the lines are... What was the problem?
I can see absorption
parts of those. Oh, you will. Hang on. No, they're not nebular. No, they're not nebular. No, it's not nebular. 91 BG has gone nebular by this age, right? So its lines are narrow compared to normal Type 1As. They're not as narrow as this, and they're different lines. So, I don't have many more. Just finish with O2CX and its neighbors. Okay, so now, this is a plot I made lately. 56 days again, and here's the 227, the one that goes really now. Well, please just take a look and see if you think that one spectrum has anything to do with the other, except that this is much more resolved. I won't give you too much time to look, because I want you to see what I see, and that is, if I take the 227-day spectrum and I smooth it. Now, I told you it's not noise. It's I'm really smoothing away real information here. And I blue shift it by 2,500 kilometers per second, and then compare them and ask whether one spectrum has anything to do to the other. and I say that this is really, especially if you start from the blue and look at the future correspondence, it's the same spectrum. It's just that the velocities, the lines are forming deeper in the ejecta. Now, in the red, some things change. In particular, I should have moved this up here where you could tell what it means. Forbidden calcium 2, I think, is that. And then this thing has come up, and I don't know what it is. I think it might be oxygen line. But the calcium 2 infrared triplet, it's still there. It's just that it's becoming resolved. So what it turns out is that I thought this spectrum was mainly, most of it's permitted Fe2. So is this. It's permitted Fe2 at more than 200 days after maximum light. And the velocity at the photosphere, is that what you're asking? 600 kilometers per second. As I'm about to show you, 600, not 1,000. Here's the zoom in on the sodium. So we just zoom in. The famous sodium D line's at 5892 angstroms. We see them as one here. Or at least they're computed as one. Maybe we see them as two. Okay. So everything else in here I haven't labeled. Anything that's in the Sino spectrum is Fe2. And this is sodium, P Cygni profile, 600 kilometers per second. And I would bet anything you want that that is permitted sodium. Now what that tells us right off the bat is there's sodium down deep, almost at the bottom of the ejecta.
Well,
so not everything burned.
It's telling you there's no kinetic energy.
No kinetic energy, did you say?
Yeah. And you might expect that if it didn't burn completely, then
you might
burn
at all.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's just not burning.
Well, there's some silicon at maximum lighting under. All right, zoom in on the calcium infrared triplet. The H and K is too blended over there to see anything. Again, V-fold is 600, and what we don't often get to see this in the infrared triplet. We see the two strongest, the Sino spectrum and the observed. You see the two strongest, there's a triplet means there's three, but the other one's weaker and you don't actually see it. So I think, I'm convinced that there's calcium down there as well. And I think, I would not bet everything on this, but I think there's oxygen at 600 kilometers per second. You asked me about this yesterday, but this is not the nebular line, as you see. Okay, this now...
Any carbon?
I have not been able to identify any carbon, but I can't say that I should see it if it's there, so I don't know about carbon. Again, anything other than... This is O1, the strongest optical permitted line of O1. We see it at maximum light, 7773. Everything else that's in the Sino spectrum is Fe2. Now, obviously, there's stuff that has not yet been accounted for. This, I think, is correct, and the reason is that the lines are so narrow that we don't have the typical kind of ambiguity in line identifications that we have, because the 017773, you see it makes a P Cygni profile that does just fine. And you don't have to search a line list, 20 angstroms on either side. You only have to search a few angstroms on either side, otherwise the line wouldn't fit. And I can't find any other plausible line that would not require many stronger lines elsewhere in the spectrum that would be bad. So I'm pretty sure it has oxygen down deep. But even if you don't believe the oxygen, if it has sodium down deep, obviously not everything is burned.
So the carbon, you don't see it like 6500
or 7200? No, I don't. But they're pretty high excitation, so I don't know if I should see them. That was really a quantitative question for you rather than for Sino.
Yeah,
I don't think I should try to answer that based on Sino. Now, I only have two left. It won't be 2 hours, but it's more than one. Okay. And here's why I say it's a new subtype. I've showed you O5HK, the one that people are observing now. It'd be really interesting to see what it does. But here's some more. This is going to appear in the Zha et al. Paper. Here again is O2CX at maximum light. And here is another new name, O3, that's at GQ. Well, you can tell here on his figure. That's Sohrab's figure. And he doesn't have the epoch with respect to maximum light, so he just gives you the observation date, but you see that it's a lot like O2CX. It's the same beast. Then here's O2CX at 56 days, the one that was had thought to be Dawn Nebula but didn't. And here's the same supernova, O3GQ, again, they observed it later. And the correspondence between those two just seems beautiful to me.
So they kept those up their sleeves for 2 years.
Right? I don't know when they reduced them. I don't know. I'm not responsible for that.
I don't know how to see.
Sometimes spectra don't get reduced. Sometimes they don't know what to say about them. So they put them in the drawer for a while. But these two spectra, so what that means, the importance of this, I think, is that I thought of this guy as some kind of freak before, you know, the most peculiar type 1A. But it's not some chaotic thing that can't be interpreted. You might have multiple velocity systems and so forth, and we never figure it out. But no, it's repeatable. Okay. And then, down here is the O2CX 227 days, the one we've just been looking at. And here's a different one, O5P. And this is all I know about O5P, is that this spectrum, it's not as highly resolved as that one. Now, I don't know if it's the spectral resolution or not, I must ask. But anyway, the general features are the same. So it belongs in this class. So we have O2CX, O3GQ, O5P, and the one that doesn't appear here, but you saw before, O5HK. We've got four of them in that class.
Do you have the estimate of the Nicodemus?
Excuse me?
The estimate of the Nicodemus?
About like 91 BG. And yet it's very different from 91 BG in many respects, so here's my summary for you to argue with. O2CX likes a subclass. It's not alone. Okay, let's see what O5HK does as it ages. It's 2 months past maximum, as I said before. I hope they observe it very carefully. Okay, but now about O2CX itself. It has iron, three lines near maximum. They're the most conspicuous features. So in that respect, it's like 91T. Now, I think really what it has in common with 91T is it's hot at early times, and so you get to see Fe3. But it may not have anything else in common with 91T. On the other hand, as you just asked, it's very subluminous, that we can conclude it has low nickel mass, of order a tenth, let's say, as opposed to a six-tenths for normals. Low nickel mass, therefore subluminous, and that's like 91 BG. The other extreme, these are two extreme peculiars, but at opposite ends. And as some Paulo mentioned along the way, yeah, but very low kinetic energy, lower than 91 BG, that's a difference. And it has sodium 1, and I believe that has oxygen 1. Actually, there's more oxygen lines in the spectrum, and they do more harm than good, so I think the oxygen is probably right. At very low velocity, and here's my guess. In the context of current explosion models, it's important to say that because explosion models evolve, right? But in context of current explosion models, I would suggest that O2CX likes, they could be weak 3D deflagrations, while the other type 1As may be delayed detonations or gravitationally confined detonations. It's a variant of the standard delayed detonation. This is the one that came out of the flash center at Chicago that some of you will know about. These characteristics of O2CX and its strong differences from 91BG make me think that if I look at the models available to us, this is maybe what happens. Maybe it's showing us what happens when you don't get a delayed detonation. There was something I wanted to say. Yes. The guys, especially like the Munich guys,
I was just going to say, the NPA supernova?
Yes. people are constantly after them to produce stronger 3D deflagrations so that they could account for the normal 1As. And I know that your opinion and my opinion is not going to work. But nobody asks them, show us a weak one, a really weak one. Can they make really weak ones?
I would guess
they can make them as weak as you want. So these may be nearly failed supernovae. They may be weak 3D deflagrations, or it may be that all 3D deflagrations are weak like this. It's just an idea, something to think about in the context of current models. Okay, finally, well, this is really for spectroscopists, but since it's here, I'll read it. So I did say this along the way. They have permitted lines even after 200 days. This is why I think, Paolo, that this is one reason, it reinforces my belief, permitted lines never really go away, even in the nebular phase. And their highly resolved spectra will clarify, will help us clarify the interpretation of post-maximum spectra of other supernovae. So for those of us who do the all little wiggles in the spectrum, it may be a bit of a Rosetta Stone. I hope it will be. I think it will be, actually. But for those who are more generally interested, then I think this is the conclusion that I have to offer. Thank you very much.
Do you
report the galaxy or those four? I just don't. If there was some clear difference between these and the others, I would know it by now. In fact, it would be in the preprint. So I don't have anything, I don't have any information on that.
Can put BG like is mostly elliptical.
Yes, the BG likes, they tend, statistically at least, tend to come from older populations. That's the one thing that seems clear about populations, right? About whether these come from older populations or even younger ones, I don't know.
Is the late Likert decline any different from the,
I haven't studied the light curve, but I know just know what Wei Dong Li says in emails. Yes, it went slow. Late time decline was slow. You're nodding? Yes. It looks like we need a lot of mass at very low velocity. Assuming that we're still blowing up a white dwarf completely, if we stick with that paradigm, then we really need a weak one that leaves loads of mass at high velocity, a little mass up at 7,000 or higher. And if we go back to the sodium, just a couple back, there's something I forgot to mention. I fit the... When I do the FE2, then I get the 600 kilometers per second. That's a firm number in SINO terms. And so then I just use the same optical depth law for sodium, and you get this P-Cygni feature, which is fine, convincing to me. But then if you look at the observed spectrum, it looks like there may well be an extended blue wing in the sodium going out to much higher velocity. But not very high by supernova standards. 7,000 kilometers per second is probably over here. So some matter at high velocity, but most of it stayed very low velocity. And at these late times, see, the sodium absorption goes pretty deep, doesn't it? It doesn't go to zero, but it's pretty deep. So that means that most of the light must be coming from underneath. Most of the light is coming from below 600 kilometers per second. Otherwise, the sodium cannot absorb it. So we need a lot of mass in there. Then if you find out that that just won't work, then we're going to have to give up the exploding white dwarf paradigm, at least the completely exploding white dwarf paradigm for these guys, and say that there's something left inside providing the light. I've only thought just a little bit about that.
What was the total explosion energy for 2000?
I have not done a calculation. Well, again, it's for power to figure out. But if the characteristic velocities, boy, this is very rough, because you can take maximum light velocities and say, compare 7,000 to 12,000 and square it and call it a factor of 3 or 4 down in kinetic energy. But then if you work from the late time...
The assumption.
Right. If the mass is Chandra. And then at late times, if you did the comparison, you would get a bigger difference. So to power of 10, let's say it's 10 to the 50 instead of 10 to the 51 ergs, is just to the power, nearest power of 10. Mm-hmm. Maybe a factor of 10, sub-energetic.
I just wrote down 2 times 10 to the 50.
2 times 10 to the 50? Fine, close enough. Now the normal ones are almost 2 times 10 to the 51, so yeah, we can call it a power of 10 among friends.
7 divided by 12.
Hmm?
You're doing 7 divided by 12.
I did 7 over 12 and squared it because it's b squared. But then if you do that at some other epoch, you'll get some other answer. So I can't do it very well.
And you think these are really discrete? There's not going to be.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So all that stuff about continuity, and I even want the 91T. My guess is that still continuity extends. Remember in that diagram of all the arrows and things down to the lower left? I'd keep 91T in there with the shallow silicon group. But the O2CX, even though I had it in that group, because spectroscopically, yeah, it's sort of like 91T, it's fundamentally different. So, yeah, in terms of discreteness, I'm thinking that O2CX-likes are a discrete subtype. I don't think they have any polarization. If they do, they're... O2CX, they don't have any polarization, or it would have been, at least in the paper we're preparing. But O5HK, I don't know what they have. They sent me one Keck spectrum near max, and they're going to send me more when they are reduced. But I don't know if they have polarization. Good question.
Where the location?
In what galaxies?
Yes.
Ken asked a similar question, and I don't know the answer. If they are in some special kinds of galaxies, they haven't told me yet. Now, we see their names. We could look them up on the Padua website and find out where most of them are, maybe not the most recent. Find out which kind of galaxy, at least. But I have not done that. And they have not made any fuss about it, and we've been passing a draft back and forth, so I suspect they don't see anything remarkable about that. About the host type.
Well, there is an interesting historical tell here, which is every time we make this sample up, we seem to come upon really new types of supernovae. So last time was 97, which left 98 BW before the fact. So God knows what this is going to be.
Yes. Paolo and Ken and I were here in 1997, and we're sure it was 1997 because it was a strange new spectrum that we were interested in, 97 EF.
You assume that everything is spherical.
This is all 1D, yes.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't mean I believe it.
No. Well, but the fact that these spectra look so similar seems to support something like that.
I think, yes, especially for the coronals, yes. Yeah. In fact, yes, there's a strong constraint there.
Yeah,
if you want to have lumps and clumps, then you need many of them.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter which direction you look.
Yeah.
Or else you need none of them. You can't just have six. Yeah. The O2CXs, on the other hand, if they are 3D deflagrations, well, then in the models, they are very clumpy and chaotic. But I have no evidence to the contrary, as long as there are lots of lumps. Lots or few.
If you would fuse two white lumps, would that be produce something spherically symmetric? You have all of angular momentum
sure.
If you do that.
Yes. And it could be more massive than 1.4.
Yeah, that's something that did not come up in our lengthy discussion. But that continuity business, sure, part of it could be asymmetry caused by rotation, perhaps, or angular momentum. And then you're jerking at different orientations.
Yeah.
There's too many possibilities for it to be sorted out at the moment, I believe.
But for the core normals and the others, the velocities were pretty similar too.
Yes, so everything's pretty similar.
Yeah.
Except O1EL has a special feature up at high velocity. But its photospheric spectrum looks normal.
The 91T-like features should be reproduced either high luminosity or high temperature model well. Also, very low luminous
motor. Yeah, okay. Yes, all right. Well, here's one of what Paolo thinks, but here's what I am thinking. The FE3 in 91T, okay, 91T made a lot of nickel. So whether it had a lot of extra iron on the outside or not, it's going to be hot at the surface, hotter than normal. FE3, fine. But why the O2CX? And we discussed this just a little bit yesterday. If it's a 3D deflagration, they have the nickel 56 all spread out in radial coordinate rather than hidden underneath the silicon. And therefore, it seems natural to me, although nobody has calculated this, that the surface of these O2CX-likes, it's not out at high velocity, it's down at 7,000 kilometers per second, but it will be warmer than normal because there's a higher mass fraction of nickel 56 near the surface, even though the total amount of nickel 56 is way down. Hypothesis. What do you think?
At much later times, when you've got the photosphere in at 600, you're saying that most of the light still has to be coming.
It has to be coming from underneath that. Otherwise, how does the sodium become a deep absorption feature?
Still, a significant amount of the nickel, which would be heating and making the light, has to be inside.
Yes, yes. Now, of course, by then the supernova has dimmed dramatically after 200 days. So that some of the nickel, let's finish that though. Some of the nickel has to be under it, assuming that it's still nickel powered and it's not some other thing sitting in there, a neutron star or something. If it's nickel powered, we need some of the nickel below 600. But the outer layers have gone out, and the supernova is much dimmer than at maximum light, so I don't know how much of the nickel we need down there. We just need some. Okay? We need some of the nickel everywhere, is sort of what we're saying. But we don't need a lot of it. Paolo?
I was just trying to work out the numbers, but if you spread it out too thinly, then you will be pushing the light curve forever.
Because the gammas will escape more easily? Why does it decline more slowly?
So if you balance to 0.1, let's
say. Yeah, 0.1, 0.2, I don't know.
You want some of it very deep.
Yeah.
Yes. You have so much left.
Yes.
To do what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And that would be very non-LTE because you'd have radiation field complete non-equilibrium wave length. So isn't it just a volume effect? Everything is moving just more slowly. With a factor of 2 in velocity, that is a factor of 10 in volume, which leads to heating, giving more or less the same 1V average, I mean angle average, distribution of nickel. Look into that
a bit more. Now this really does bring in the light curve, which I just haven't studied that. I don't know what radon says.
Light. The photosphere will go with that because it's allowing to drive that photosphere.
I'm sorry. The second part of what you said?
If you bring in the nickel further out, the photosphere will go with it because that's where the lines are, and the photosphere is basically lines, so it will continue with this point.
Yeah.
And then you may actually end up with an interval of the nickel mass which is above what you have. So either you manage to trap some of it so that the maximum light somehow doesn't show all the nickel, but that sort of seems to defy our basic understanding. Well, it's just a small thing. Maybe more massive for us. I mean, the E over M will certainly be quite small. Because V is low, but maybe
E is low, but M, we don't know that it's low. Certainly E over M has to be low,
yeah.
No matter what M is.
Yeah.
E over M is low. Velocities are low.
No.
Something to think about.
One is modeled light and spectrum together, and the second thing is get a nebula spectrum, because whenever it becomes nebula.
And the
not O2CX, I think, it's gone. But O5HK.
The light curve will be also usable because it would be curious to see the decline rate and the absolute luminosity.
Yes.
Because I would be very surprised if it goes down with the decline rate similar to, I mean, all the other are staying on 1.5 magnitude under 100 days normal in the nebular phase, that's
yes.
The decline rate.
Yes.
And it would be very surprising if it is this day on the
same. Yeah, why would it do the same? Yeah. Okay. So are you guys observing O5HK?
I don't think so.
Okay. Filipenko just told me that lots of people are. It's hot, and so he wants to get the O2CX paper out as soon as possible, of course.
the underlying light source, and that's due to the decay of nickel?
Well, that's the
cobalt.
Well, of course, cobalt by that time, the nickel's all gone. But we call it nickel.
The light comes out, and the photosphere is then it shines on the photosphere, and this produces the spectrum. But that's very deep.
Yes, that's the simple-minded picture I have. I call it a photosphere. It's a pseudo photosphere, of course. But yes,
but inside it's still very optically thick.
If it was a well, I don't want to say that. The permitted lines are shaping what comes out. But whether they are shaping a true continuum from underneath or a quasi-continuum consisting of a bunch of emission lines, forbidden emission lines, I don't know. I wouldn't say that it's optically thick. I just say that the optical depths in the permitted lines are clearly still high.
Yeah.
Right? Has not gone nebular in the sense that we ordinarily speak.
When do most, like the normal one is, when do they go nebular?
Yeah, some people have assumed, there are papers where they've gone nebular like 40, 50 days after maximum light. I've never believed that. And but if you go 200 days after maximum light, probably
I always thought nobody was would. The first ones to go nebular, and it went nebular about 100 days.
Which one?
Beechey.
Okay. Fine. Yeah. And yes, so it wasn't your papers, by the way. I was referring to where people have treated them as if they're nebular at 50 days, and I don't think that's right. But of course, there's a gradual transition, and what we mean by nebular is a little nebulous, because I'm claiming that even at very late times, where it's not a continuum, it's forbidden emission lines, the spectrum is still getting reworked somewhat by the permitted lines, that the optical depths won't go away. Nebular in the sense there's no underlying true continuum. The underlying spectrum is emission lines.
And your total energy, you need the light curve for that, to know what the total energy is.
Okay. Well, from many crude estimates, but everyone agrees, for normal type 1As, you look at the velocity, and you assume you got a Chandra mass, you've got 10 to the 51 ergs, or a little more.
Okay.
And so here, even without using the light curve, we can just do what we did before. We can just scale on the velocities and scale it to just get some idea. And the conclusion was, it's maybe down by a factor of 10 in energy.
You know what's the thing that really worries me? There's no big oxygen pollution.
I know.
But why would it be that by a factor? Then what has happened after the other stuff?
Yeah, in the 3D deflagrations, there's only partial burning, so there's a whole lot of unburned material left. And in a weak 3D deflagration, which has not been published as far as I know, because they're trying to make strong ones, it could be that lots of material is not burned. Ari, you were trying to say something.
I don't know.